so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatments of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, April the 13th, 2018. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here by our guest co-host, Darren Chang.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Amir Ali.
Good afternoon.
Today's show is packed with content facing humans and animals in today's world. On the cusp of last week's announcement that energy infrastructure company Kinder Morgan would be ceasing all non-essential activities in the building of its pipeline because of public opposition, we have a short interview today with filmmaker Zach Embry to give us his thoughts on this latest news. Zach has recently debuted his new film on this exact subject, and it's called Directly Affected: Pipeline Under Pressure. We'll be learning more about the film as well. For our last interview, we'll have Jody Monell on the show. She's another person working towards educating the public through media. Jody is the founder and CEO of the online community called Live Kindly, which you may have heard of as it has a huge following of now 500,000 people on their Facebook page. And that's just been in the past year since they've started. Live Kindly is a place to find the latest news, recipes, and resources that promote vegan and compassionate living with a further message that encourages a shift towards a kinder world. That interview is coming up in about 38 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. Now, this week's show features a trio of interviews, and for our second interview, we'll have Darren Chang here to speak on a topic he has written a paper about while completing his master's degree in political philosophy at Queen's University in Ontario. The paper speaks on the politics of farmed animal sanctuaries and proposes an idea that could engage and grow the animal liberation movement by making changes to incorporate farmed animals into intentional suburban communities. Now, I'm really interested to talk to you about that, Darren, but first, you used to be a regular guest co-host here at Animal Voices, and now you're living in Toronto, but you're visiting in Vancouver here for a while longer. I know you're actually heading off to Victoria right after the show. I wanted to say thank you for coming on the show today. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, we wanted, I know you had announced that you were coming for a month, and I'm like, we have to have you on the show to talk about whatever you want, what you've been working on, actually.
Right.
So just for people who don't know, Darren was extremely active here in the animal rights community in Vancouver when you lived here. We miss you. And I know you're still active now being in Ontario, but I'm wondering if you can just share with us maybe some of the highlights of your visit here in Vancouver so far.
Oh, for sure. Well, first of all, I definitely don't miss the rain here.
Today is one of those days.
But I locked out the first few days when I came back. It was really nice. It felt like summer. What was supposed to be more of a vacation has actually turned into a bit of a work trip for me. So I'm currently working as a research assistant for Dr. Kendra Coulter at Brock University. She's a professor in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University, and she has a strong interest in learning more about human-animal relations, and she has this really cool project called Humane Jobs, and you can learn more about it on humanejobs.org. And basically what Humane Jobs is about is that it's a project that advocates for transitioning and shifting industries and workforces away from damaging patterns and towards more sustainable and positive practices and employment sectors. And of course, this would require the improvement of certain existing areas of work, as well as the creation of new humane jobs. So as a smaller part of this broader kind of project, she's been getting research assistants in various cities to go interview vegan business owners. So
is that what you've been
doing?
Yeah,
I've been doing that.
That's
so
like,
great.
That's what my job is at Animal animal voices, but not all businesses. But that sounds fun. That sounds right up my alley. Who have you interviewed?
So far in Vancouver, I've interviewed Chickpea. So Rolton at Chickpea, Glenn
Great
at Nice Shoes, Alex at Eternal Abundance, Jim at Virtuous Pie.
Yeah.
I've been all over the place.
All the good ones.
Laura Simonson. She's the
vegan dog food company. We had her on the show not too long ago, actually.
That's really cool. And I'm looking forward to interviewing Karen at Blue Heron Cheese soon next week.
Have you been to the Blue Heron Cheese Creamery yet?
I haven't.
They're sold out every week, and they're only open on Saturdays.
These interviews are basically giving me sort of excuses to visit.
To go and try. I was going to ask, like, what?
Oh, and David Isbister of Plant Based. Can't forget.
Have to pay him a visit, of course.
Jason Anthony, I'm hoping to get to interview him as well.
Well, that sounds like a super fun job. Now, I know, too, you were also asking on your social media before your trips, like, what are all the new vegan places that have come out that I haven't been to yet? So you've been able to, some of these that you've mentioned, they're actually brand new. They didn't exist when you were living here before.
So that's one thing that's really great to see is how much vegan businesses have exploded within just a year and a half that I've been away. I left in summer 2016, so it hasn't really been that long, but the city's changed quite a bit and a lot more vegan food around.
No kidding. Well, thank you for that, Darren, and more with you soon.
Cool.
Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM is political.
Co-op Radio is poetry.
Co-op Radio is tango.
Co-op Radio is gay.
Ecology.
Comedy.
Feminism.
Philosophy.
Yoga.
Reggae.
Bicycles.
Trade unions.
Gospel.
Live.
Local.
Asian.
African.
Vancouver Co-op Radio is community.
Your community.
Vancouver Co-op Radio.
CFRO.
100.5 FM.
All different.
All the time.
Our first interview is with Zach Embry. He's the director of the highly lauded new film called Directly Affected, Pipeline Under Pressure. 5 years ago, Zach set out on a mission to understand the impacts of the Kinder Morgan pipeline on local communities and to give a voice back to those who have been ignored by the National Energy Board process. On today's show, he gives us his thoughts about the latest actions in this ongoing story and will tell us more about the film. Hi, Zach, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on the show today to share with us your thoughts on the pipeline project issues and recent news. With Kinder Morgan having announced just last week that it will stop all non-essential funding to the project until further notice in May due to the opposition of citizens, what are your predictions on how this may progress in the next few months? Do you think that this project is dead? Is this an exit strategy for Kinder Morgan?
Well, I think what we're definitely seeing is that Kinder Morgan has blinked, and they are realizing that the opposition to this project is massive and represents a significant threat to their investors. And, you know, this could go any number of ways. I think that the ball is in many ways in the court of Ottawa right now and how Trudeau decides to press forward, or if he's ready to realize that that the opposition is just simply too strong and that this was the wrong project for him to back.
So the Kinder Morgan pipeline project violates both the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and the UN Paris Climate Accord. I'm just really surprised that Justin Trudeau backs up this project anyway. So how is it that our federal government is allowed to get away with keeping forward with this? Are there nuances involved that I don't know about, or is it, do you just see it as an outright unjust violation?
Well, you know, Justin Trudeau admitted in a National Observer interview a couple months ago that that they had done some horse trading with Alberta in order to get the Pan-Canadian Climate Framework signed, and that they had said that, well, we'll get you one pipeline to the West Coast if you'll sign on and take on carbon pricing and agree to start regulating within the Pan-Canadian Climate Framework. And so, you know, Rachel Notley and Justin Trudeau have really wagered their political, you know, futures on the success of this pipeline and getting it built. But, not only has, you know, is there widespread opposition from all corners of BC and really across the country for anyone who's seeing that this isn't responsible in terms of our, it's not responsible in terms of reconciliation with First Nations, and it's certainly not responsible when we look at our ongoing contribution to climate, and to ignoring our Paris commitments. So it's,
Yeah, so with regards to how such a pipeline can be a deadly threat for our wildlife and oceans, can you speak to us about concerns for oil spills and other environmental disasters? And I'm interested in learning more, too, about climate change and how that is affected.
Well, you know, there's a number of pressures that are on our oceans, as everyone knows. Plastics, the significant, but also the ongoing acidification of the ocean. And this is because of the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere is dissolving in the ocean and then increasing its acidity, which makes the development of many of the foundational development of life, of life forms in the ocean difficult, right? So in terms of the pipeline itself, the increase in tanker traffic would be a 400% increase in tanker traffic. So they intend to bring 34 tankers a month into the Burrard Inlet. And even if there isn't a spill, the increased sound pollution could have significant effects for the southern resident whale population in particular, but I'm sure all of the animals that call the Salish Sea home. But in particular with the southern resident killer whale population, it could very well lead to their collapse. And this is something that Kinder Morgan themselves have admitted in their submissions to the National Energy Board. If there were to be a spill event, and really with the increase of numbers, the possibility of a spill is not really a matter of if there's a spill, it's a matter of when there's a spill. These are actually fairly technically difficult waters to navigate, and the tanker traffic in the inlet is increasing. And so with all of that comes a profound increase in the possibility there's a breakage. And that could affect, you know, the shellfish, the juvenile salmon, the forage fish, marine animals, orcas, all of them this would contribute to significant pressures. We learned from the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill that 25 years later, the herring populations have still not returned to their original numbers. And we know that the herring populations are a building block sound like population for the wild salmon, for the whales. And so this could have significant effects throughout the ecosystem if there were to be a spill in these waters.
Well, the ecosystem also includes us humans, and I'm wondering if you can speak on human effects of exposure.
Well, from the research that we uncovered, and this was in the submissions made to the ministerial panel, so Trudeau's ministerial panel, there was a researcher out of the Eastern Ontario Children's Hospital that found that the toxic effects. So the thing is the material that they're moving through here is not just oil; it's called diluted bitumen. So it's a very heavy oil product that is then mixed with a diluent, which is very volatile. So when it spills, not only is the spill happening either on the land or in the water, but also in the airshed. Because of the volatile quality of diluent, when it goes into the airshed, it's highly toxic to humans to breathe in, and the toxic effects tend to multiply with the high sulfur content and the high heavy metal content of the bitumen. So what the researcher from the Northeastern Children's Hospital, Northeastern Ontario Children's Hospital, found Meg Sears, was that exposure at any time can contribute to chronic disease and even death. And these are the kind of diseases that can lurk in your body. So exposure doesn't necessarily result in illness right away. It's almost like exposure becomes like a time bomb in your body, and so it can accumulate and stay dormant there for years until eventually your body is overwhelmed by the toxicity of what it is that you've been exposed to. We've learned from the Mayflower oil spill, which was also a tar sands diluted bitumen spill, was that the airshed around the area of the spill is so intense that they actually had to buy and destroy the homes in the area. They weren't actually physically oiled, but the spill in the air was so intense that anything that was exposed to that air was now considered too toxic to leave standing. And so, you know, a lot of people don't understand the nature of the material that they're planning on moving through these waters and how truly dangerous it is for humans, for animals, and also, you know, for the climate. When we dig up and burn all of this, we know that we're hitting tipping points. And so on all of these levels, I find it just outrageous that we're talking about this in terms of being some kind of net benefit to the national interest. The risks that BC are being asked to take on are enormous, and in the process, we're also shrugging off our larger responsibilities to Indigenous people and also to the community of planet Earth in terms of our responsibility to climate change.
Well, thank you for shedding light on these issues to our listeners, because it's multifaceted. I wouldn't have known about all those different things. Well, finally, you have just made this film, Directly Affected, Pipeline Under Pressure. You spent the last 5 years working on it, so please do tell us about it.
Well, this, you know, the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline's in the news every day right now. And so I really encourage people to come out and see this film. I've been following this story. My co-director and I, Devin Brugge, have been following this story for 5 years. We've followed it all the way through the regulatory process and all of the ways that people who had concerns about this at every single step along the way have been sidelined and marginalized in order to push forward an agenda that benefits, you know, oil companies and the agenda of the oil industry. And so this film represents everything that you need to know. You need to understand, why is it that people are actually lining up to get arrested to stop this project? Why is it that the province of Alberta is standing up to oppose this? Why is it that Indigenous people are saying enough is enough? We do not give consent for this. You know, many of the Indigenous communities who already have the original Trans Mountain Pipeline going through their property, through their reserves, were not given an opportunity. They weren't even allowed to hire a lawyer back in the 50s when this first pipeline went through. And now these communities are saying, you know, no, we don't consent to this. And the federal government is outrageously saying, well, maybe we'll roll in the military to make sure this thing gets built. We're moving towards a potential constitutional crisis in this country because of the building of this pipeline and the agenda to build this pipeline. And I think it's really important that everyone understands all of the factors that have gone into this defining moment that we're in right now and get educated. And I really encourage Vancouverites to come out to our screening at the Rio Theater on Earth Day, April 22nd, doors at 3:45, showing at 4. We're going to have a great panel discussion afterwards. And we hope to actually have a regular day at the Rio. If we can fill that one up, we're going to get some more screenings in Vancouver for that. And then we have a number of other screenings around the province for those who aren't in the greater Vancouver area. If they go to directlyaffected.ca, they can go to our screenings list. And we have a number of community screenings coming up over the next 2 months.
Well, thank you so much, Zach, for joining us today to give us your thoughts on the latest news on the Kinder Morgan Pipeline Project. Once again, to find out more about Zach's film on this issue, please visit directlyaffected.ca. And you can also attend next Friday's film screening on April 22nd at the Rio Theater in Vancouver. Thank you so much for your time, Zach. Have a good day.
Thank you so much.
So, yeah, that was a great interview, right? And we have more news. This has been in the news this past week. But, Darren, you have some news that you want to share with us.
Yeah, so the newest item I wanted to share has actually been in the mainstream news media for at least a few weeks now, and it's about the animal rights protest against the restaurant Antler in Toronto. And basically what happened was, for those who haven't been following the story, what happened was a few weeks ago, a group of activists decided to protest this restaurant called Antler that focuses on serving wild, what they call wild meat, to their customers. And what caught the activists' attention was that they would sort of, you know, have snarky comments making fun of vegan lifestyles or making fun of animals on their sandwich board. So one of them had a message like venison, which is the meat of deer, is venison is the new kale or something like that. So that really caught people's attention. So they started protesting there weekly. And at one of the protests, that the chef actually got so frustrated that he brought out a leg of an animal, which we would assume was the leg of a deer, and started cutting it in front of the protesters in, outside his restaurant. And that entire thing was recorded on video. And since then, it's gone completely
viral.
You were
there, right?
I was at the protest. I showed up a bit late, so I didn't see the leg part, the leg cutting. But later on, he actually brought out another piece of steak, and he was eating it in front of the activists, and I was there for that. So obviously it's very confrontational, but I think the important thing to mention here is that this restaurant also serves foie gras, and it's hard to see how
fatty duck liver, for anyone who doesn't know what that is.
How force feeding ducks by shoving tubes down their throat has nothing to do with hunting and foraging in the wild. It's the farthest thing from that, right? And the fact that a lot of people also don't realize that these so-called wild animals are actually confined and raised on game farms. And that's where they source a lot of their deer meat, is on game farms where, you know, hunters will go and like shoot them in a confined area. So it's not really wild either. Anyways, so I
but there's an
to
update, right?
There's been an, yeah. So
what's the update?
I guess the update is that the activists are now trying to negotiate with the restaurant owner, and they have basically proposed that if the restaurant is willing to put up a sign that says something like animals' lives are their right and there's no humane way to kill or exploit an animal who doesn't want to die, that kind of a message, then the activists stop the protest. So it's interesting to see where that goes, because it looks like the restaurant's not willing to back down just yet.
Then the activists aren't going to back down.
Nope.
So someone else who isn't backing down is our Liberal government, as they have allowed the annual Canadian commercial seal slaughter to recommence again for this year's season. That started this Tuesday. So that means that sealing boats will crash through the ice as baby seals desperately crawl to escape, but there's nowhere to hide, and soon they'll be shot and bludgeoned for their fur. So here are some facts about the seal hunt, if you don't know. More than 2 million seals have been killed since 2002, with 98% of them being younger than 3 months old. The method that is used to kill them is they are shot first, then bludgeoned, and then killed. 82% of them are not killed with the first shot, and this is from research done by Humane Society International. So who are killing the seals? It's commercial fishermen, and they get these sealing licenses, and the sealers make up actually less than 6,000 people in Canada. And the income brought in from the sealing makes up less than 5% of the sealers' annual income, because they're commercial fishermen throughout the year. So there has been the proposal for years now that the Canadian government could make up that 5% by issuing a one-time sealing industry buyout, compensating for any lost income and investing in sustainable economic alternatives. I don't know why they haven't done that already. The fact is that 36 countries around the world have already banned the import of seal products. Most recently was India in the news, and that's because of the cruelty involved. So now the Canadian Sealers Association, they want to lift a freeze on commercial sealing licenses so they can recruit and train a whole new generation of baby sealers. And there's a petition to tell the Canadian government, Justin Trudeau, our Prime Minister, to object to this absurd proposal and to also put an end to the industry of sealing once and for all. And you can find that petition on the top of our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. You can also listen to past shows. We've done many interviews on this issue in the past at animalvoices.org. And Darren, you wanted to say something about the seal hunt.
Yeah, just really quickly, I think it's important to point out that, you know, for a long time, animal advocacy organizations have maintained this distinction between indigenous subsistence hunts versus the Canadian commercial seal hunt. And I think in recent years, more and more indigenous animal indigenous activists have spoken out and shared their perspective, and basically trying to break down that distinction and saying, trying to make the case that many indigenous sealers are actually part of the commercial industry now. So it's a bit of a trickier situation now. And I just wanted to highlight that. And there's a film called Angry Inuk for anybody who wants to learn more about that perspective.
Well, Our second interview is coming up, and our interview guest is sitting right here across from me. For our second interview, we have former Animal Voices guest co-host Darren Chang to speak with us about his past research studies. He is visiting from Toronto and recently completed his master's degree in political philosophy with a focus on animal liberation theory and critical animal studies. As part of his studies, Darren has written a paper entitled Organize and Resist with Farmed Animals, Prefiguring Anti-Speciesist Anti-Anthropocentric Cities, which is an essay that discusses the politics of farmed animal sanctuaries and proposes an idea in which we can progress their implementation in the animal liberation movement. So thanks for joining us again today, Darren.
Hey.
And yeah, so for people who are regular listeners of Animal Voices, they will be familiar with the practice of animal sanctuaries and farmed animal sanctuaries, especially as we support them and feature their stories on the show quite frequently. I know that not everyone, though, is familiar with the ethos of an animal sanctuary. So can we start by you explaining to us the origins of sanctuaries and what they are meant to be for the animals who inhabit them?
Sure. And actually, before getting to that, I just want to say that, too, I'm by no means an expert on farmed animal sanctuaries.
But you wrote a very long paper on it.
Yes, but in that sense, I'm very much a student of farmed sanctuaries. I think there are a lot of really interesting practices and knowledge that that we could learn from the from farmed sanctuaries. But basically, for those who aren't familiar with what farmed sanctuaries are, farmed animal sanctuaries essentially are places where that provide a refuge and shelter for farmed animals. You know, each year billions of farmed animals are killed, and every so often few lucky ones will get rescued, either because they have escaped or somebody found them somewhere, or actually going into farms and slaughterhouses and taking them out and rescuing them. And these lucky ones get to live out the rest of their lives in a more peaceful environment, and having, you know, being cared for and so that's what farmed animal sanctuaries do, is they provide refuge for the animals. They offer them care, but there's also an advocacy dimension to it. So farmed animal sanctuaries also tend to advocate for veganism and animal rights. And what they do is they try to get people to see individual farmed animals as precisely just that, unique individuals with unique personalities, with their own life histories, with their own stories, and trying to get the general public to just respect the animals more. So that's basically what farmed animal sanctuaries are about.
Well, I want to talk about where these animals actually come from and why they need asylum and sanctuary. So in your paper, you discuss the role of farmed animals in the context of war. And what is this war between animals and human society? So if they need sanctuaries, would we consider them non-human asylum seekers and refugees?
Sure. So this idea that the dominant relationship between humans and animals is actually one that is akin to warfare is actually something that I got from this professor at University of Sydney, Dinesh Wadawal. He wrote this really great book called The War Against Animals. So that's his main argument, is that, you know, historically, humans have always tried to maintain sort of sovereignty over non-human animals, regardless of what context, what species, to dominate them, to exploit them for our own benefit. So in that sense, we could understand our relationship as primarily one of war. So I basically took that idea and suggested that, you know, if in fact that our relationship between with animals is one of warfare, then in that sense we could definitely understand farmed animals as refugees, as fugitives when they do try to escape, or perhaps even combatants in some cases when they do fight back for their own lives. And this is not just for farmed animals, it's for any animals, really. You know, we could apply the same idea to wild animals held in captivity in zoos and circuses or aquariums. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly been stories about how animals have resisted and fought back for themselves.
You posted one on your Facebook just this week, those cows with the calves.
That's right.
The dodo has great stories, escaped from their farm, you know, their industry farm, and into an animal sanctuary of all places, right?
It was a mother and a calf, so her child, the two of them escaped together, and they weren't sure. So the farmers who technically own these two animals were trying to get them back and send them to slaughter because they want to get their money's worth, but the latest update has been that apparently the sanctuary actually has raised enough money now, and you can find this story on the Dodo, that they've raised enough money to actually keep the animals.
Yeah, the reason I didn't post that is because I don't support buying animals from the industry. Yep. So we didn't want those animals to die, right? But then the farmer was expecting $1,600 for his investment.
Yeah.
But that's not usually the typical way in which an animal is rescued.
Yep.
So I want to talk about the typical model, which is rescue and advocacy. If you could speak to us more about this model and then what concerns for animals that could be raised as a result of this model.
Sure. So there's this great paper called Farmed Animal Sanctuaries, The Heart of the Movement, A Social Political Perspective. It was written by Sue Donaldson and Will Kimlicka. And this is this article is actually open access, so you can download it for free online. But in the article, they basically highlight six sort of main principles through their research. They realized that there are sort of six main principles that all sort of existing farmed animal sanctuaries that are operating within the refuge and advocacy model that they sort of follow, right? So the first one is non-exploitation. So obviously these animals were rescued from being an exploitative industry. So the idea is like we can't exploit them anymore. We won't put them to work. And there's the principle of care, providing care to these animals. There's respecting them as individuals. But there's also sort of more kind of controversial practices such as seizing reproduction, so preventing the animals from reproducing, because the idea there, the logic is that it would be unethical. Since there are so many animals out there that need our help, it would be unethical for us to allow rescued animals to reproduce, to bring in so that more animals are brought into this sort of horrific and violent world. So these are some of the main principles of the refuge and advocacy model. And of course, yes, the education aspect, the vegan and animal rights education.
Yeah, so it's not a perfect model. It's recognized, right? But I mean, neither is this world we live in. And the fact that these animals are being rescued from all kinds of crazy situations to put into this place where they're meant to live out the rest of their lives forever and also be ambassadors for the movement, like that's part of it as well. Like what are your thoughts towards the ambassador role of animals in sanctuaries? Is that something that we should advocate for still?
Right. So this is definitely a bit of an ongoing debate. And I think an important thing I want to mention is that these are all critical discussions within the farmed animal sanctuary movement right now. There was actually a great conference last September at Wesleyan University that has a really great animal studies program there. And they co-hosted this conference with Vine Sanctuary in Vermont. And they got directors and staff and volunteers from various different farms, sanctuaries together to discuss these issues. And what's revealed is that, different farmed animal sanctuaries have different philosophies and different kinds of practices. And because of that, I think we can't just kind of generalize and say which ones are what better, which ones are worse. And to go back to the question, which was
what do you think of the role of animals acting as ambassadors?
Yes. So some sanctuaries definitely sort of want the animals to play more of an ambassador role,
and they encourage visits from the community.
They have visitation programs, and because these animals have now rescued, they demonstrate how wonderful life for these animals could be if they were given that opportunity. But there are others that sort of see ambassadorship as sort of an identity that, or a job that is kind of imposed on the animals. Like they didn't choose to become ambassadors, right? So we should at least allow them the opportunity to decide if they want to engage with human visitors. We should respect that instead of just saying like, hey, you've been rescued, so now you're an ambassador.
You know what? I know you and I have both been to quite a few farmed animal sanctuaries, right? And I'm just thinking that when I do go to them, definitely there's animals who want to be, they come out and they welcome you and they say, hi, welcome to my home. And I was just at Happy Herd recently and Larry and Mo come out, they're turkeys, and they come out and always greet the visitors and they're very friendly. They are actually literally ambassadors for the sanctuary there. And a lot of the other animals too, they enjoy the human interaction. So I think that's something to be considered in this model.
Yes, it's definitely going to vary a lot between different animals, right? Because ultimately
they're all individual
preferences.
Yeah.
Some want to interact more
just
with
like the little doggy in the station today. She did want me to touch her. She just wanted to play with a squeaky toy and she just kept coming to so we could throw the toy. But then she let me have some cuddles with her.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO Vancouver, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
So, I want to talk about the micro-sanctuary movement, because you do discuss this movement in your paper, and then you propose something that's sort of similar to it. What is the micro-sanctuary movement? We actually have not covered that movement on the show before.
Sure. So, the micro-sanctuary movement is this relatively new movement. It was co-founded by Justin Van Cleek, who is an animal advocate who has been rescuing a lot of animals over the past few years. Mainly, I think mostly chickens. He's definitely a chicken expert. And so, according to him, the goal of micro-sanctuary movement is to basically try to demystify the idea that farmed animals only belong in the country, so rural setting that we're used to seeing them in, and in fact that many farmed animals can live perfectly great lives in a more suburban or urban environment with their companion humans or rescuers. And so they propose that, you know, we have this idea that in order to start a farm sanctuary, you need to have a lot of land, a lot of money. So that's another thing they're trying to sort of challenge as well. And with the idea that actually you can, you know, if you just have a house and a backyard, you can rescue a few animals. You don't need to rescue a lot. You can rescue a few sort of smaller ones like chickens or potbelly pigs, and you can provide them with high quality life. And then that's a way to start to get more farmed animals into the spaces where often they're actually made invisible or excluded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we live in really urbanized environment now where we never see farmed animals besides in, you know, advertising or in supermarkets when their bodies have already been chopped up. So there's a huge disconnect between the human consumers who eat these animals and the animals themselves. So,
and so I think what you're proposing, you do make a proposal in your paper, which sort of stems off the micro-sanctuary movement, but I think what you're proposing more too is that we incorporate animals into intentional communities in suburban communities, sort of like in city areas where normally quote-unquote farmed animals are not allowed. Can you speak more about that?
Sure.
And the idea behind like what that can do for the animal liberation movement?
Yeah. So we don't have much time left in the interview, but I just want to quickly summarize but also say that it is a very kind of controversial proposal, and I'm not being naive about this. So the ideal vision really at the end of it is, at the end of the day, is I kind of envision this entire network, this movement between humans who are harboring farmed animals in cities that are technically considered illegal, and that's a form of civil disobedience. When laws are unjust and they segregate various members of society, we should challenge those laws. So in order to challenge laws that prohibit farmed animals from being in cities, we need to we may have to break those laws in order to challenge those laws. But then the more traditional farmed animal sanctuaries that are already so well established and have tons of resources and knowledge to share, they could be part of this network that provide training and knowledge and resources for humans who want to, animal rights activists who want to adopt farmed animals into cities, right? So it's not that, you know, I'm not envisioning a situation where there would be a competition between like traditional farm sanctuaries and like new sort of urban micro sanctuaries. I very much wish that all sort of sanctuaries could come together and work together as part of a cohesive and united movement and really tackle some of these deep issues.
And I would love to see a world where in suburban communities, it's a normal thing for, as I see in the dodo sometimes, for a family in a house with a backyard to have a bunch of dogs, a few cats, I don't know, a pig, a turkey, a couple of ducks, and that's their family. Because you don't just need humans in your family, right? I envision having a family with members of various species of the world,
right.
and that will make our world a better place. So, Darren, very quickly, you're going to be speaking at tomorrow's Animal Advocacy Camp in Victoria. Tell us about that, please.
That's right. So this year, the Animal Advocacy Camp is happening in Victoria at Camosun College, and it's happening from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tomorrow, Saturday, April 14th. And we've requested that the organizers keep the registration open a bit longer, but supposedly...
Because it's supposed to end at noon today, and I said, but we're announcing it at 12:38.
Yes, but there are six great speakers. well, I'm not so great, but I'm one of the speakers.
You're one of the great speakers. You can hear more about Darren talking on this subject because there's more, lots more to talk about.
Yes, yeah. And these speakers come from all different sorts of activists and academic backgrounds, so it's going to be really exciting. More information on animaladvocacycamp.com.
Great. Thank you, Darren, for speaking to us today about your research on the politics of farmed animals and your proposal of integrating farmed animals more into our suburban society as a forward step towards animal understanding and therefore liberation.
Thanks for having me.
Our final interview is with Jody Manel. She is the founder and CEO of an online community called Live Kindly, which you no doubt have heard of if you enjoy social media on veganism, as they are a leading source of content in that area. Live Kindly is an online community of vegan and plant-based news, recipes, and resources. And today, Jody will be speaking with us about her vision of veganism in today's world. Hello, Jody, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak with us about Live Kindly and the exploding vegan movement. Live Kindly offers a plethora of all types of content on compassionate living and the vegan lifestyle. I like to regularly repost your postings that I see in my Facebook feed because they are also lovely and eye-catching, but also informative. Now, I'm wondering if you can talk to us about when did Live Kindly come out onto the scene, and can you tell us your vision for what you want it to be?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, funny you should ask, because tomorrow is our first birthday. So we've only been running 1 year, which is kind of crazy considering we have, I think it's over 500,000 followers on Facebook at the moment. So it really kind of snowballed and was much bigger than I anticipated. I always hoped for something big to come of this, but kind of exceeded my expectations. So yeah, we've been running for a year, and I guess my vision for Live Kindly was really to build a more inclusive platform for veganism and help perpetuate this movement forward in a different way than it has been in the past. I think that veganism comes with a lot of negative stereotypes and a lot of stigmas from people who are not necessarily involved in the vegan movement, especially when it comes to mainstream media. So I really wanted to tackle that and build this really inclusive platform where everyone felt welcome, no one felt judged, and it was more of an educational community for anyone, you know, depending on whether you're vegan, vegetarian, and you still eat meat. You know, there's a place for you here because everyone is on a different spectrum of going to a more ethical way of living. And yeah, that's kind of my vision, and that's still what I'm working towards. We're no way near getting there yet, but
I don't know about that. You have so much great content. There's such a diverse amount of content on your website and your social media, and I see Live Kindly as a venue that promotes making vegan living as an easy and accessible thing, and really just normalizing the vegan lifestyle into our culture. And I wonder if you can talk to us about the diversity that Live Kindly offers in content to appeal to a broad spectrum of internet users. Like, what kinds of things are you posting on a daily basis?
So we focus on a lot of the positive news. And I know that with a lot of vegan platforms out there, and I know for myself previously being, you know, more of a frustrated, angry vegan when I first kind of made that transition personally, and realizing that doesn't really resonate with a lot of people, and people don't respond to the anger because they don't feel empowered by it, and it makes them feel ashamed about their decisions. And instead, we really wanted to kind of focus on more of the solution rather than the problems. And that's not to say that the problems don't exist, because they very much do. And we want to be a platform that is educating about the ethics and the animal side of veganism and why we're actually doing this. And this is my whole motivation as well. But it's really empowering people and how you can make a difference, and how your choices do have consequences, but you aren't in a position to change that. And I think with us focusing on keeping our content diverse, is that you can do this from any walk of life. So we really hone in on very kind of localized news stories and in small towns, We're also focused on, you know, different recipes from different cuisines around the world, and we try to involve as many different people as possible, and really just show that it's not for someone, you know, white and wealthy. It's really accessible for the majority of people who live on this planet.
Well, one thing that really pulls people together in society and culture is food, of course, and Live Kindly has no shortage of beautiful and enticing posts and videos of vegan food. And I especially love recipe demo videos. Can you tell us some of your favorite recipes that you've recently featured?
Oh, well, we do lots of recipe roundups because there are just so many amazing, creative vegan food bloggers out there at the moment, which are just really inspiring people to get creative with their cooking at home and making it much more accessible. So we really like to showcase a lot of these bloggers and these cooks and these other platforms. So specifically with the Canadian side of things, we've obviously featured Hot for Food quite a lot, and in Erin, Ireland as well. And I think for me, someone who is originally quite a big foodie, and I had like a food blog myself before I started Live Kindly, I'm always drawn in by the colorful, bright recipes, and I want to see lots of that because it's really the way to a lot of people's hearts. Is that, you know, if I know I can have a tasty, you know, cheeseburger or something and still be vegan and do something good, then yeah, of course I want to do that, and I'm going to feel healthy. So yeah, I mean, some of my favorite ones, I really, you know, it's so hard to pick because we just focus, we showcase so many of them. But I think some of my favorite ones are when we showcase different kind of cuisines. Like recently we had a recipe post for the Passover, for the Jewish holiday. And I love learning about, you know, different countries and different ingredients that we can use. And I know that for my personal journey with veganism myself, you know, I expected it to be very restrictive and cutting out all of this dairy, and I didn't ever eat that much meat, but you know, I actually just found a whole new world with food and became more and more inspired to try different ingredients, and it's still, you know, I'm still growing in that area as well. I'm always inspired and always learning new things every day. So yeah.
Cool. Well, I know you don't just post food recipes on your site. It's so much more than that. And I really appreciate that Live Kindly is an up-to-date source of information, of news happening in today's world with regards to veganism and compassionate living. Now, every day, pretty much, I'm seeing reports online on how plant-based eating is expanding worldwide. And that's included on your website as well. Can you perhaps tell us about some of your recent news stories that speak to that?
Yeah, we really, it's almost kind of unbelievable trying to keep up with some of the new data that we're seeing at the moment with the growth in veganism. I know that just recently in BC, we saw a study which showed 40% of people 35 and under follow a vegan or vegetarian diet, which is just incredible, you know, for BC alone. In the UK, I think the growth in veganism like tripled. It went up to about 700% increase within the last 2 years. And I think in the US, it was 600%. So we're seeing such positive data coming out every single day. And it's just reinforcing that all of these, like, you know, small individual acts that we are involved in our personal day-to-day lives are really creating a huge impact. And it, you know, it's so easy to get bogged down as a vegan and feel that, you know, one person, just my, you know, my breakfast choice isn't going to make a huge difference to the way that the rest of the world is eating. But I mean, the data is not lying. It's happening. And it's so empowering and so encouraging for me to see this every day that I just love sharing that news with everyone. And it, you know, it's not just in Western countries as well. I know that in China, meat consumption is dropping as well. And you know, change is happening in, you know, all walks of life, really.
So I'd like to talk about intersectional issues and how you address these with your content on Live Kindly. Just this week, you published an article noting that a new study found that swapping out meat for vegan food could address world hunger issues by feeding an additional 350 million people. So it's important to acknowledge, I think, that while veganism may be a fun and trendy thing these days, it's actually a shift that could improve the world on a global level with so many problems that we face, such as world hunger, the environment, and of course, our health. So what are your thoughts on this and how addressing these issues fit into Live Kindly's mandate?
Well, for me, it's always been about the holistic approach to veganism. You know, I came into veganism because of the ethical side and the environmental side of this. And then I kind of found the health benefits afterwards, and it was just a bonus. But so when I developed Live Kindly, I really wanted to focus on how to really incorporate all of these benefits into one platform and really speak to all of them. And we even have it in our tagline that Live Kindly it means to live in a way which shows appreciation for our humanity, our home, and those who share it with us. And that's really speaking to all three of those areas. And I think that the more you think about veganism and the more you think about life in general, and we realize that everything is connected, that, you know, doing one good thing really benefits something else. And I think that for me, we really try to keep a broad overview of the content that we're putting out and making sure that we're hitting all three of those main areas. A lot of people do find veganism through health and then become animal activists or you know, just find the ethical side of veganism and the other way around as well. So I really, for me, it's spotlighting the benefits of all three of these solutions and obviously educating on the issues itself. And I think the more that we can start connecting these together, the more impact we'll have, because, you know, not everyone is going to come to veganism through the ethical side of things. That doesn't mean that they won't find it, but a lot of people, you know, it's not going to speak to them initially. And the same with the other way around. You know, some people are never going to be interested in the health side of things. So we can't always be promoting veganism for the health benefits. You know, this is why we will showcase vegan junk food, because we want to make it accessible for everyone. And we really want to speak to as many people as possible. You know, not everyone is going to have the same interests. But I think what resonates with everyone is that everyone wants to do a little better and everyone wants to be a better person. Everyone wants to be more compassionate and everyone wants to live more kindly. So yeah, that's really my view on things. It's just to really keep it holistic and really create a balance with the content that we're sharing so we can speak to as many people as possible.
I really love that answer, Jody. That just really resonates with us here at Animal Voices, because we sort of have the same mission. We want to spread veganism and compassionate living, and we're media as well, right? And I totally understand what you say about reaching people to as many places as you can, because you never know what's going to affect someone and how you're going to be able to reach through to them and plant seeds about veganism. So yeah, thank you for that. We're like totally on the same page there. So you seem to have a great team of people who are helping you. You have a base in Vancouver. I know you're based in the UK as well, and you've got contributors from all over the world. For our listeners who are inspired and would like to help with Live Kindly, can you tell us how people can get involved to contribute?
Yeah, definitely. So we are we're the only, I believe, international vegan media publication. So we do have writers in the UK. We have some in North America, which includes LA, Vancouver, and also in New York. And we have one of our, she's part of the furniture now. She was here before the website was live, Nadia, who works in New Zealand. So we really are across, you know, as many time zones as possible. And the reason for that is because there is just news happening everywhere. So we really want to be on the ball with all of the breaking stories. So if anyone does want to get involved, you know, we are expanding quite a lot this year. We're always looking for skilled writers, and you're more than welcome to submit an application. Just email hello@livekindly.co. So that's just C-O, no M at the end. with a cover letter, and we definitely love to connect with more people who are mission aligned and really feel that they have some skills to offer. And it's not just with writers as well. We are always looking for other people with other skills in the realm of media, and just collaborating with as many vegan brands and ethical people who are moving the needle as possible.
Well, thank you, Jody, for joining us on today's show to speak about Live Kindly and the great work you are doing there to promote sustainable and compassionate living. You can find Live Kindly on Facebook and on the web at livekindly.co. Thanks, Jody. Have a great day.
Thank you, Allison.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show on Friday, April the 20th, 2018. It's our annual Earth Day show, and we'll be talking about how adopting a vegan lifestyle can help save the planet. I also wanted to do a quick reminder for Jillian, our co-host Jillian Walters' Kickstarter campaign. She has 13 days to go, and we were speaking with her on the show last week about this campaign. She has written a children's book called King Zoom the Vegan Kid, Volume 1, Animals Used in Food, and it's a wonderful educational book for children, and there's nothing like it out there. She wants to print 1,000 of them, and she has 13 days to go to raise the money for it. So if you want to support Jillian, I did, so I think you should too. Go to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and you can find out more there. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download podcasts, and you can subscribe via iTunes. You can stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. Please send us your suggestions and comments about the show, and submit any animal-related events you would like to have announced on the show, either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Today's closing song is dedicated to Sean. This is Dark Angel by the Canadian band Blue Rodeo featuring Sarah McLaughlin. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
Met this girl, she was walking through one of my dreams. She kissed my eyes and everything that she said made so much sense to me that I still feel like I'm half asleep. Well, my dark angel, she gave me diamonds for eyes. She walked by, now I'm hypnotized by this dream that just won't stop. And I feel like I've always been lost in this dream. The rumors of heaven only speak the truth on earth. My dark angel, shine your light on my curse. You are the other that I have to find until I do. I guess I'll see you round. place I have to go. I heard a rumor she loves a man and snow. Well, my dark angel, she gave me diamonds for eyes. My dark angel, I offer you my heart. My dark angel, think I loved you from the start. 'Cause there's this face that I know that I've never seen. Sometimes I feel I'm living in someone else's dream. Still I thank you for stopping to talk. And I wonder just into whose dream did who your love.